The Open Source Creative Podcast, episode 55, Blender 5.2.
Oh, we're going to toast marshmallows, are we?
Could be.
This is the Open Source Creative Podcast, a podcast where I ramble on about creativity, process, and open source software. I'm Jason Van Gumster, your host and driver on the road to creative freedom. Which, come to think about it, it's a little bit weird to say that. I was saying that tagline I've had for this show for a long time, and it started because the show started in my car when I was driving to day job stuff. Flash forward however many years to where I am now. I'm still on the road, but I'm not commuting to work. I'm living on the road. Yay! Anyway, minor digression. That's not what this episode is about. This episode is about Blender 5.2, which, as of this recording, should be coming out tomorrow, July 8th, because I'm recording this on the 7th, so that's how that works out. Yeah! So I wanted to go through what to expect with this new release of Blender. This is going to be Blender 5.2. It is an LTS. LTS is, for those of you who are not aware, LTS is long-term support. It's adopting the same model that Ubuntu uses for their releases. So what happens is that the Blender 5.2 series will be supported for the next 2 years. So patches, updates, security fixes, those sort of things will go into Blender 5.2. Even though there will be a 5.3, 5.4, and 5.5 after the release of 5.2. 5.2 itself will continue to be supported for the next 2 years, which is really good for those of us who are either doing documentation and education about it, writing books, or doing tutorials, or writing add-ons, or if you happen to be in an actual production, that's a stable base that you'll have full support for 2 years. That's one of the main significant points about the LTS releases. They also tend to, as opposed to the big number changes, like changing to 5.0, they're not as breaking compatibility-wise with previous versions. So there's a few compatibility things in 5.2 relative to older versions. And what I'd like to do is sort of just go through and talk about what sort of changes that are going to be in there, because there are a number of them that are really pretty cool, really pretty exciting. And some folks I know are a little, what do I do about doing, if I'm doing something right now and I'm using 5.1 or 5.0 or 4.5, are my files going to open and look weird in 5.2? Is my workflow going to be broken? Those sort of things. By and large, the answer to that is no. Oh, I should also mention, thanks for the feedback on last week's episode, episode 54. I did have a few people reach out and talk to me about SIGGRAPH, so I will be seeing some of you there, which will be super cool, which we will catch up, have coffee, have food, hang out, and have a great time. That's gonna be a ton of fun. And so thanks for reaching out and talking about that. And I did have one person try to take a guess at where I stand in AI, and they were close, but not on point. We had a nice conversation about that. That's still another episode to come, but not this week. This week, again, is Blender 5.2. So let's go through the first thing, probably the most important thing to talk about, is what's breaking, what's different, what compatibility problems are you going to run into versus anything before 5.2. And fortunately, those are very few. The biggest one, as we've gotten pretty used to, there are some changes when it comes to geometry nodes. And fortunately, for most situations, you should just be able to open the file. So you did something in Blender 5.1, or 5.0, an earlier version of Blender using geometry nodes. You should be able to open the file of 5.2. There'll be a little sort of version flop over. And when you save in 5.2, you should be good to go. You probably You may run into trouble trying to reopen that file in the earlier version of Blender, but if you're just going to upgrade to 5.2 and be set there, you're good to go. So that's the biggest thing is that issue with, there's a few changes in geometry nodes that are going to be there. There is also a minor change, I think, in how cycles calculates a few things. So there's a chance that some renders will end up a little bit darker in 5.2 versus 5.1. More accurate, a little bit darker. So if you're mid-production and you're using 5.1 or an earlier version, even though there might be some enhancements, improvements, and features in Blender 5.2, finish the production in the current thing if you're at the rendering stage. If you're not too rendering or look dev, I wouldn't worry about it. Personal opinion, do your own testing. Let me know whether or not I'm full of shit. All right, so I'm actually going to work through this. There is a release log on the Blender Developer website. I sort of went through that and I sort of pulled out the ones that I felt were most salient and most relevant. And I'm going to kind of go through them mostly in order. And the order is alphabetical by feature set. So the first area is animation. One of the cool things in animation is actually, it was introduced in earlier versions of Blender, is the notion of a breakdowner visualization. So if you do animation, there's a breakdown visualization. It's taught in a lot of like traditional animation books where you have sort of end marks for the beginning and end of the animated sequence. And then you have steps for each of your keys. You get to see your primary keys and your breakdowns, and the breakdowner lets you see the timing without necessarily seeing the animation. You'll see sort of a flow, and it's more notch based versus a curved based sort of visualization. And it shows up. The cool thing is that it shows up right in the 3D viewport. Unfortunately, up until now, it only worked when you were in pose mode. Now it works in object mode. You'll be able to have and see the breakdowner visualization in object mode, which should make, again, object mode animations feel and be have the same sort of functionality and tools that you get when you're working just in pose mode. So if you are animating something that is not rigged, now you can have the advantage of the breakdowner in there. The small thing, the copy constraints operator is now in Control L. It is with all the other sort of Control L used to be the dumping ground for dealing with linked data. And it was also like where you would copy modifiers, which semantically doesn't make sense, but workflow wise is kind of a similar place to put it. So they put copy constraints in the same space there as well. This is for those of us who used to use the copy attributes add-on that used to ship with Blender way back. The functionality of that add-on over time has been sort of progressively migrated and is in Blender proper. So copy constraints now, Control L, you'll be able to find it in there. The other one that's really cool related to animation is some new playback features. So you're gonna have some pre-roll, which will help with caching, so it won't, you'll be able to get up to frame rate more fasterly. Basically, hopefully it's gonna the way it works is it pre-rolls frames so that you have a working cache to play from. I think that's the basis for it. The other advantage of it was that there's a weird control issue where you couldn't play starting before your first frame. If you start, for instance, if you have a scene where you start at frame 100, for instance, Blender, and you put your time cursor at frame 99 or 98 or 30, it didn't quite play right starting that early. It would jump to the first frame and start playing from there. Now it'll pre-roll play from wherever the cursor lives to into your play space, which can help for understanding lead-in and those sort of things. But there are also some more loop modes that were added too. So before it's just this infinitely loop when you press play. Now you can keep infinitely looping, but you could also do a ping pong and a restore, and it's a stop at start and stop at end. So if you play in reverse, it'll stop at the start. If you play forward, you can choose to have it stop at the end, and or change basically more options for playback loops so that you can get a better sense of the movement while you're animating. This, of course, assumes that your rig and everything is set up to work well in real time. If you have a animation with a lot of characters or a very complex rig or an old computer, these looping tools are not going to benefit you very much simply because you won't be playing in real time anyway. So either have more simplified rigs or a better computer, I suppose. I didn't check to see if these loop modes work on the, when you have a play blast or a preview render set up. That would be really convenient. I really do hope that that works out fairly well. If that's not already in there, I really hope that it does get in there, because that's really useful for the regular playback tool. So that's the overall thing for animation. Now, working through in the alphabet, the next thing is assets, the asset library. There are two really big deal kind of things coming to the asset library. One is that there will be support, I guess, in 5.2, because I'm still before the release of it. In 5.2, there will be support for external online asset libraries. So not just the libraries that you set up on your own local hard drive, you can connect to an external online asset library. And then the first example of that is what the Blender Foundation or Blender Studio, the development team, are calling an online essentials asset library, where they have a bunch of things that are assets that are, so brushes, particularly grease pencil brushes, which I'll get to in a second, but brushes and geometry node networks and materials and models. I'm sure that's going to expand, just like the extensions project has for add-ons and themes. That's also going to expand for assets. And so there will be the online essentials asset library is already pre-configured and will be set up. And that's an online one, and you can sort of download assets on the fly when you need them. You can choose to do that. But you can also set up an external online asset library. This has two main benefits. The first one, personal thing for you, would be you have or if you're working on a team, you have an online asset library that lives somewhere on your own server that your team, your collaborators, your colleagues, whoever you want, are working with you. Everybody can have access to this asset library. Works, and it would work, or you could set up specifically for a production. So you could say, this is our asset library for this production, and you can build your production around that workflow. The other part where that's beneficial, and it hasn't, I don't think it's in action yet. I'm almost positive it's not, but I do know that some of the online asset libraries, I'm talking about things like Polyhaven, Superhive, BlenderKit. I can never get the name of them right. In any case, those platforms that have asset libraries and they're online, with some configuration for use with the API, and of course with being able to correctly connect to their servers with some authentication, you can be able to download those assets on the fly. You don't have to download these giant multi-gigabyte asset packs for just the one material you're looking for. You can actually have an online asset library, browse through it with the asset browser and say, download this one. And you download it and you can use it in your production and go from there. Assuming for some of these third-party platforms that you've paid for that asset, of course. So that's actually a pretty cool thing. It's a really big deal from a workflow standpoint, not just for individual production workflows, but it's also, I think it's very, very valuable for the overall Blender ecosystem of people who are making assets, who are making products for us to use in our own productions. They have an easier way of doing it, because one of the funny things is that a lot of these asset libraries are, people don't always, they're not as accessible, I guess, because you have to go to a website, because you have to search through it to find it, and because then you have to download it and put it in your asset library. The onboarding and the workflow for that is time consuming and annoying. So this also helps reduce that level of friction if once you have that connection there. So that's I think that's pretty cool. I'm excited to see how some of these platforms adopt it. Hopefully they adopt it pretty quickly, because it'll be a useful feature for those platforms, but more importantly for the creators who are selling things on those platforms. So there we go with that. Moving forward, the compositor has some cool things coming into it. There's a few of them, actually. One of them is that grease pencil objects now register in terms of depth, but only in EV. So grease pencil objects don't show up on the depth pass for cycles yet, but they do show up on EV. And in case anybody has never had to do this workaround, it totally works. You can, if you're rendering in cycles, but you have, for instance, something in grease pencil, and you need that grease pencil thing to be in your cycle scene, you can't have a separate scene that renders in, that's a copy of all the content linked from your cycle scene, but set EV as the render engine, and then just use the depth pass for that. I admit it is a bit of a trying to get your ass, go around your ass, get your elbow sort of workaround, but it works, and it will work until the time that we get proper depth passes for grease pencil objects in cycles. Until then, that's the workaround that works. And if anybody's curious about how to do that, let me know, and maybe I'll make a quick like 30-second video on how to do that, because it is a really helpful way for taking advantage of features that are in one render engine but not the other. The other one that I often do this for is the shader to RGB node that only works in EV. Anyway, moving forward, the compositor also has a string to image node now, which is really helpful for just throwing text on top of whatever graphics that you have on there. So it's basically a text tool that doesn't require you making text in the 3D space. You can literally write it right in the compositor and do things like little text overlays or callouts or those sort of things, which is really valuable because you don't need to worry about rendering a whole 3D scene if you just need 2D text overlay on it. Good time saver for those of us who do motion graphics stuff. And another one that is really helpful, hovering socket inspections. This happens not just in compositor. I think this is also going to be available in the other node editors as well. You can hover over a socket and see the values coming out of that socket, at least at the meta level, not per pixel, obviously, because that'd be too much data. But you'll be able to say, look, this is RGB data coming out of the socket. This is a value of just 11 coming out of the socket, that sort of thing. Really easy. Otherwise, you're just like we've been for years, sort of guessing at what the number is that coming out of there, or you have to do some sort of a lot of weird math to get that to display. And this now you just hover and you find it out. So socket inspection is really cool. And there are a couple more nodes that are being added. The one that I thought that was most impressive, or not most impressive, but the most useful, is a film grain node, just a straight up film grain node. There are a lot, if you look for it, there are tons of tutorials on there about how do I add film grain to my compositor nodes, and people have these giant compositor networks to replicate film grain. Now it's one node that ships with Blender 5.2. So now I won't say that those tutorials are useless, because there's a lot of other information that you can gather from doing those tutorials that are useful in other applications, not other applications, that can be applied in other ways in Blender. But unless the results from those tutorials or those shipped film node products are better than what this node can do, there's no reason to use them. So cool. And then the interactive compositor, that is the compositor that you see in the 3D viewport, because in the 4X series, that was added. For most compositor nodes, you could actually see them in real time in the 3D viewport. In the past, though, it didn't support animating the 3D viewport with the real-time compositor. Now that works in 5.2. So there's been enough of a speed boost in the in the interactive compositor that's possible. So sweet, more cheating and sweetening with compositing that can be done without actually rendering, and you can see the results early. All wins there. Moving forward to the next thing in the alphabet is cycles. And there's a bunch of cool stuff that's technical in there. And it's to be honest, unless you're doing a lot of render stuff or you're really focused on rendering, the biggest one in there worth paying attention to is a texture cache. And that gives you some of the advantages of real-time renderers or game engine renderers. Basically, you can take when you're doing, especially when you're doing GPU acceleration, especially for textures that don't change, you can cache those and they're static and you just reference them over and over and over again, right? Blender Cycles hadn't had that. And this way, with that optimization, if you have a static texture that is doing what it needs to do, you can actually choose to pre-cache your textures so that your startup for rendering each individual frame is faster, which reduces your overall render time when you're doing cycles, particularly when you're doing animation. So nice performance win for there, basically borrowing some of the ideas that are used in real-time engines and where it's applicable, using it in a ray trace engine like Cycles. Of course, since we're talking Cycles, and since it's also next in the alphabet, EV improvements, ironically, the screen space ray tracing in Cycles has been overhauled. This is where I said at the beginning, and I guess I misspoke at the beginning, is that because of this overhaul, you have more accurate ray tracing, screen space ray tracing within EV, better performance, so it's faster, but it might be a little bit darker. So there's a little bit of a compatibility break there. If you're rendering prior to 5.2, either switch everything over to 5.2 when you render with EV, or stick with the previous render. If you don't need the performance, if you don't need the extra features, if you don't need, I guess, the better screen space ray tracing accuracy, stick with the earlier version. Or if you do need that stuff, migrate your whole production to 5.2. Not a fun choice, and I'm glad I don't have to make it right now. Yay! The other thing is that EV lights also support ray visibility, which helps in terms of setting up, mostly when you're setting up your shaders, but can also help on the compositing side as well. Cool. Now getting to the thing that everybody always loves to talk about, the highest velocity development section of Blender geometry nodes. The biggest thing that, and this is one of the topics that everybody has been referring to for a while now, is the physics simulations that are allowed, that are happening in the geometry nodes editor now. In the 4X series, there were simulation nodes that were added. That wasn't necessarily physics simulations, but the ability to do sort of iterative loops over and over again to do a kind of simulation within Blender. Now, proper physics simulation is in Blender experimentally. And that's the important note to say there, is that the physics capabilities for geometry nodes in 5.2 are still experimental. That means two things. One, anything that you've done, and there aren't, well, I just should back up again. They're experimental and they're focused primarily on cloth and hair dynamics. Those are the two places where the development effort is focused on right now, which means first and foremost, any physics simulation that you've done with the legacy system that you did prior to 5.2 will still work. And by and large, unless you need a very specific feature, you need to do something with geometry nodes, the recommended way of doing it would be to use the existing system prior to 5.2, because we know what works. It's been vetted as far as debugging with its current workflow. You know its limitations. So, and it's not, more importantly, because development is going to be focused a lot on this geometry node workflow, it's not likely to change. So if you want to work, if you're doing a production, if you're doing an animated short, if you're doing something longer than that, if you're doing a VFX shot, my recommendation, unless you very specifically need something that's happening from the geometry node space and you're willing to accept the fact that, one, it may break in the future, and two, it may not work as expected right now, stick with the legacy systems. But the experimental one is still game for playing with. Just keep that in mind, that shit's going to break. So know about what's going on there. In any case, still some really cool, exciting things coming through there, because with being able to do physics in geometry nodes, now you can do things like hair tearing. I guess you could do that too, but cloth tears and these sorts of things and sort of mix some of the physics engine, physics behaviors together a little bit more reliably. This includes things like effectors. You have a whole host of effectors and those sort of things. You have, because of the addition of this physics simulation feature, Geometry Nodes has a bunch of other things added to it that would support that. For instance, lists. So you can have a proper list data structure to work with within Geometry Nodes. And you can also deal with collection children. Both of those things are pretty valuable for some of the evaluation steps necessary for doing physics simulation. So now they're available for other non-physics related Geometry Nodes setups as well. The other things that are added, sound sampling. So if you want to drive animation or drive movement in Geometry Nodes using sound, you can do it with this sound sample frequencies node directly within the node editor. I think based on the notes, I haven't tested it yet, but based on the notes, it seems to me like playing the actual sound, you still have to use the thing of dropping it into the video sequence editor to actually make the sound listenable in time as things go. But for the data, for the sound treated as data, as a data input for Geometry Nodes, the sound sample frequencies node is the way to pull that data into your node network. The other one is the mesh bevel node, which a lot of people are really excited about. Basically all of the availability, all of the features you get with the bevel modifier are now available as a node within your node network. Super handy for that. And there are also NURBS control. So I know that there's a lot of effort to use Blender's Geometry Nodes editor to give improved NURBS editing for people who are, one, familiar with that workflow. Usually you're seeing that in automotive or CAD or industrial design. There's those sort of things where it comes from that. That's actually where that's really, really valuable. And so that's where I think we're going to see a lot of really cool additional development is, I mean, they've been talking about improving Blender's NURBS for literally decades. I've been around for it. And there's been no one to sort of carry that torch and maintain it for a period of time. So the development on it is always stagnated. But because you can do that now you can do a lot of these things visually with Geometry Nodes, we're getting a lot of people who don't necessarily have a traditional development background making some of these tools that they want and they're used to. And I think that's super exciting. Now we move forward to what I still think is one of the unsung heroes of Blender is Grease Pencil, which I adore and love. There have been a number of updates for 5.2 with Grease Pencil. One of the things that's pretty cool, speaking kind of NURBS, is that you can set the curve type for drawn curves. So for anyone that doesn't know, when you draw something with Grease Pencil, it's a vector that you're drawing. You're drawing a curve. And you can actually edit that curve in edit mode. And prior to this, I think it was just Bezier handles, or it was just the actual control points that you could move around. You didn't have as much control with it. Now you can set the curve type to Bezier, Catmull Rom, or NURBS, and use that style of control for your curve. I don't know if you can dynamically change the edit type, the curve type, like you can with regular curve objects in Blender. That'd be kind of cool. The demo they show has it, you set it prior to drawing, and then you go into edit mode, and like, oh, I can draw it that way. I can edit it that way. Sweet. So it may be set prior to drawing. I don't know if you can dynamically change it. Something worth testing. If you want, test it and let me know. I compiled it yesterday and played with a bit of it, but I can't play with all these features in one day. I've got a lot of stuff going on. The other really cool thing is that a lot of the brushes for Grease Pencil have been updated. They've removed ones that didn't make any sense. They updated the thumbnails for a whole bunch of them. And then on top of that, one of the big asset packs that are part of the Online Essentials assets that I talked about a few minutes ago are a whole suite of Grease Pencil brushes, and a lot of them are grungy and or painterly, give a lot better effect than just sort of strict vector style drawing. You can get a much more loose aesthetic with these other brushes, which I'm stoked to see that happen now. And then on top of that, there is a new fill algorithm. You can still use the legacy pixel fill algorithm, but the new Delaunay, I'm going to say it's Delaunay, could be pronounced Delaney, I don't know, D-E-L-A-U-N-A-Y, I'm going to say Delaunay, even if I get it wrong, someone will, I'm sure, will correct me. In any case, this algorithm is pretty cool because it will detect breaks. So if you draw a line and then lift your pen and then draw another line, then there's still a, there's a gap there. The current fill tool prior to 5.2 would not fill that. The fill tool now will. And so you have a lot more flexibility in how things get filled. The other thing to note is that the fill ID, this fill data is stored with the, so the stroke, the strokes carry the fill material with a fill ID attribute, as opposed to before where I think it was not stored with the stroke. Now it's stored with the stroke, which is actually pretty similar to how a lot of other vector storage, vector drawing tools do it. So it should help compatibility from, for instance, grease pencil objects to SVG, for instance, or Lottie, or as I've dealt with before, SWF. So in any case, filling is going to be improved, or is improved in 5.2, and that's really pretty exciting for those of us who do the drawing thing within Blender, because it's super cool and you should all try it at least once, and then hopefully get really excited, as excited about it as the rest of me. I say the rest of us, but I can't speak for everybody else, so just the rest of me. Moving forward, talking about modeling. So over the last few years, with each release of Blender, it seems, the features that are in the Loop Tools add-on that ships with Blender have been migrated into Blender and been made native. And so that started with like the Bridge Edge Loops and a few other operators. Those were originally written in Python and part of the Loop Tools add-on. Loop Tools add-on still exists, but more and more of that functionality is being built into Blender proper. And so three more tools were added as native operators. Loop Tools Circle, Space, and Flatten operators are now native in Blender, and you don't need to use Loop Tools to use them. So they should also be more performant. Yay! And then there were some improvements also for 3D text rendering, particularly when you're dealing with fonts that have accents and those sort of things. Prior to 5.2, those extra components of a glyph, of a letter, weren't placed correctly. Now they're placed correctly. So if you're using text that has a lot of accents or umlauts or other squiggly things that go around the letters, they should now be placed properly. So you can take advantage of Blender's 3D text rendering will do that more correctly now. So yay. In the general physics space, everything on the notes for physics was really talking about connecting to geometry nodes physics. Geometry nodes physics is using the base solver for it is the XPBD solver, which is a lot of letters, and basically what that means is that it's a unified physics solver, which could be used for a bunch of different things, which means that you could start to have cloth interact with rigid bodies, interact with soft bodies, interact with hair, all in the same thing, where you don't have to sort of fake it, where you do a rigid body simulation and then have a cloth dangling off of it and try to adjust it so that one affects the other. Now, over time, not currently, because again, still experimental, still only focused on hair dynamics and cloth, but over time, with a unified solver like the XPBD solver, whew, that's going to be a mouthful, with a unified solver like that, you should be able to use a bunch of different physics systems together, and so you could have a boat floating in water, or a cloth jacket floating in water, or rigid bodies shooting into cloth and tearing it, these sorts of things. And you don't have to do multiple passes on setup. It all just sort of would simulate all at once over time. Again, not right now, but once things keep getting developed, that seems like the route things are going. And so that's why there are also the additional effectors available in geometry nodes and all of this stuff is on the experimental side. So for the time being, unless you're willing to deal with breakage or weird behaviors, stick to the weird behaviors you already know for anything that you're doing that is sort of real production wise. That's, again, my advice. I probably won't take my own advice on that, but I feel like it's the responsible thing to say that. So there we go. Moving into rendering. This is just overall rendering stuff, but it's also sort of covered for both render engines. And that is, there's better organization for all of the different for when you do color management in Blender, we have all the different color managed models available. And it used to be this one giant drop-down list. Now it's organized a little bit better so that it's easier to find what you're looking for. Sweet. And then the render engines also have thin wall supports. And this is mostly important for transparency and subsurface scattering, because if you have the examples that they use in the release notes are, you know, a bubble, which has no thickness. It's just a thin wall. And rather than have to model that thin wall, you can use a shader to handle that for you. So the render engines now support that. Likewise, if you have a leaf, or I'll say a business card, that has a little bit of subsurface scattering to it, you don't have to use a solidify modifier or something to give some thickness for the render engine to deal with it properly. You can just use there's a checkbox in the, I think it's in the principal BSDF shader, where you say thin wall, and it should behave hopefully the way that you want it to. Cool. There are some UI. Hold on. I almost skipped a whole part of the alphabet. So sculpting, that starts with S. It comes after rendering. The biggest thing that's a change in 5.2, change or an addition of 5.2, is that there is a scene project brush. And what that basically means is you can do sculptable shrink wrap. That's what you get with the scene project. So this is actually pretty useful if you have a base mesh that is, a jacket, or you have a body, a human character, and you have a jacket and you want to have that jacket fit the body, then by a combination of this scene project brush and the cloth brush, you should be able to get pretty close to getting something that looks really nice with it as an additional tool in a much less manual way. So I'm excited to play with that one. And then, sort of related to sculpting, but more on the painting side of things, the brushes for texture paint, vertex paint, those sort of things, they now show the brush angled in 3D space. If you've done that before, you know, the brush was always sort of showing 2D relative to your viewport. Now the brushes are drawn in 3D space, which is pretty cool. And then the big thing, textures are included as part of autosave. This is something that people have been complaining about for ever. it's a big deal. The fact that autosave in the past would neglect data blocks like the texture that you're currently painting on in a 2D editor. It just wouldn't, unless you explicitly saved. If you closed Blender and reopened Blender, whatever you painted, gone. Now it's part of the autosave process. Not only is it part of the autosave process, but I'm going to talk about, since UI is the next thing to talk about, if you haven't saved an image like you should, or if autosave hasn't saved it for you, Blender will throw up a dialogue and say, hey, you've been painting on an image in Blender and you haven't saved it, so that's a problem. You should probably save it before closing your Blender session. If you were just goofing around and don't want to save the texture, then they just close Blender and then the garbage collection will take care of it for you. But that is a long-standing feature that people have been asking for a very long time, of not being able to, Blender not remembering your painted textures when you save, unless you explicitly save it either externally or within your blend file. That is, 5.2 fixes that. Let's all celebrate. Yay! All right, that's all the celebration I have for that. Now, all other fun, since I got switched over to the UI side of this, a couple other fun little things added in UI. When you set up your render dimensions, you can quickly swap X and Y render dimensions. This is mostly useful if, for instance, you are doing something and you're working in 1080p, 920 by 1080, and you want to do a vertical video render specifically for social sharing, then you can just hit the flip or swap XY button and the XY dimensions will be flipped. And so then you'll be doing 1080 by 1920 instead of 1920 by 1080. So cool, nice little quality of life thing. Another fun, interesting thing, when you move an area, the border between two areas in your Blender window, if you get those two things lined up, Blender has always defaulted to saying, oh, that's one line. And now when I move it, they move together, which is convenient when you want it and frustrating when you don't. And so now what they've done is they changed it so that even when they're perfectly lined, where's my fingers? There we go. When they're perfectly lined, my fingers are wavering. For those of you who have this in audio, I'm visualizing this with my hands, and you're just gonna have to imagine me doing this wrong. And for the people who see it in video, you're seeing me line these up. Now, if you line them up, they don't automatically stay stuck together. They're not auto-joined. If you want them to be stuck together, you press Shift, and then they'll move together as if they were joined. Small adjustment, and basically learning another hotkey, but it's not unreasonable. It beats the frustration of having those edges joined when you don't want them to be. So cool. And then another really handy one for those of us who do not have numpads, and I say those of us, I have a numpad, but for the people who don't have a numpad, being able to frame your selection, that's always been on the numpad dot key, right? I call it numpad dot so I don't confuse it with the period on the main keyboard. So the numpad dot key has been how you do that. But if you don't have the numpad dot key, unless you have it in your quick favorites or you're using the, I think it's available in the tilde navigation key. Unless you go through one of those, there's not a fast way to frame your selected object. Now, button 4 on a mouse will do it. Now, since so many mice now ship with more than 3 buttons, Blender now defaults to being able to frame your selection with button 4. Kind of a killer feature, kind of a happy benefit of that. And it'll take me a second to get used to, but I'm without throwing my hand over the numpad. But it's I think that's going to be a nice, convenient, and handy shortcut to add in there. And the other convenient thing is that the outliner now will automatically auto-scroll to whatever your active object is. So if you have, 30, 100, a whole bunch of objects in your outliner, and you select it in the 3D viewport, usually you had to go to the outliner and hit dot on your numpad to frame it in the outliner to auto-scroll to that selection so you could work on it in the outliner. Now that's no longer necessary because when you select something in the 3D viewport, the outliner automatically jumps to show that within the outliner space. Quality of life improvement, nice little bonus, and helpful for the people who didn't realize that numpad dot also works in the outliner, which it still does, but now you don't have to use it nearly as much, or maybe at all. Working our way forward in the alphabet, we've only got 2 more things left, and then we're good. But one is, so we're talking about the VSE. One of the really cool things, again, this is a big thing people have been asking for, is a compositor effect. This means you can add an effect as a strip, an effect strip in the sequencer, and that effect strip is connected to a compositor node network that pulls input from, I guess it's going to be below it on the stack, and outputs result that you can see. And you can do that with the compositor, or at least with compositor node. So everything that's available in the compositor proper is now available in a effect strip within the visual sequence editor, video sequence editor, which means that a lot of the motion graphics workflows and a lot of the video editing workflows that people wanted to do are a lot easier now compared to there were some workflows and workarounds we could do for years, but nobody wanted to do it that way, and it was kind of slower to set it up. This, it's right there in the sequencer. You have an effect that is a compositor effect, and you can just work it right there, and you're good to go. And the other cool thing is that even these effects, as well as the regular compositor effects, can use GPU acceleration. You just have to turn it on. I think it's off by default. So you can go in and turn it on. I think if you turn it on in the compositor proper, if you turn the GPU on acceleration there, it should also be respected in the VSC. If not, then somebody should fix that. So that's true. But I'm pretty sure that's the case. And then the other thing is that if you use the scopes on the video sequence editor for seeing what color gamut you're working with and those sort of things, traditionally those have all been standard definition, regular sort of scopes. Now the scopes support HDR and wide color support. So yay, very cool stuff. And the last thing on this list, last of the V's, last of the alphabet is VR. So for a number of years now, there has been sort of quiet development with head-mounted displays in Blender. You can use them. They've been doing, even with Grease Pencil, they've been experimenting doing VR head-mounted display work with Grease Pencil in Blender and using more of those sort of things. This kind of qualifies as one of the first real usable features in, I don't want to say real usable features in Blender, because people have been using VR headsets in Blender for a while. This is, the UI is a bit funky for a lot of it. But what you can do is what they're calling VR location scouting. And what that means is, traditionally, if you wanted to scope out a view and see and look at your scene, you have to get either you orbit around in 3D space on your monitor and sort of pick camera locations, and you can snap the camera to that location and be done with it and work it that way. Now you could literally walk around the scene with your head-mounted display and save different camera views that you like from the head-mounted display, and then those are saved and can be reused for your scene proper when you start doing edits for it. Really cool stuff. So I may want to play with that. I'm never really got into doing the VR thing because I don't want to wear a thing on my face. That's my own weird personal bias, but I know a lot of people get a lot of productivity and a lot of, and enjoy working that way. So why not facilitate that and let that work farther? I'm hoping that one of the things that we talked about, that we saw last year at SIGGRAPH, since I can connect this to the last episode, last year SIGGRAPH, they demoed Blender on an iPad. There has been more development with that in the Blender Labs side of things, but they haven't found their way to proper Blender releases yet. And 5.2 is no exception to that. Some of that development, groundwork is being laid for that, but it's not there yet, which is why that's not part of the main release. It's all these other features that are happening, which, I mean, nothing to sniff at. There's a lot of things in here that people have been asking for literally for decades. So super excited. And super exciting stuff to see there. And I'm, again, assuming everything works as scheduled, which by and large, the Blender team is pretty good at that. The release for Blender 5.2 will be tomorrow, July 8th. So download it, have fun with it. And unless you've already downloaded the pre-release stuff and you've already been playing with it, then tell me how you think about it. Small side note for the people who are interested in physical space stuff, because this is the open source creative prod. I can't even say the words now. This is the open source creative podcast. And so a big chunk of that is creative. And while open source is a big part of everything that I do, software isn't the only thing that I do, right? Software is not the only, digital art, digital creative stuff isn't the only thing that I do. So I'm going to be doing, I'll be at an art market thing in Richmond, Virginia, this weekend. If you happen to be in the Richmond area, drop on through and say hi, point at me, make fun of me, and I will be there selling stuff. I'll be selling the wooden rings that I make. I'll be selling the humorous pun t-shirts that I design, and I will also be selling the books that I write. So it's going to be a weird table because none of those things seem really related, but I mean, the only thing that ties them together is the fact that I do them, so I think that should be enough, right? In any case, that's happening this weekend, and I have to still prepare for it. So, it's time to get to work. See you later.
I locked myself in the ship. They've crippled me. I can't take off or fire the gun, and they're coming for me now.
And this is the last job.